Welcome to the Eugene Halliday Podcast, where we publish talks from Eugene Halliday's collected works. These talks were recorded in Manchester and Liverpool, commencing in the late 1950s up until his death in 1987. This is episode 41, The Nature of the Zeitgeist. On this episode of the podcast, I'll be reading Eugene's written work, The Nature of the Zeitgeist, which was published in 1988 by the International Hermeneutic Society. Preface by David Marlowe. For many who will read this work, there is no need to recommend the author. They know and love the outpourings of his powerful mind and heart. But for those who have not known him personally, let me say that his logos sagacity and his art alike were born up and fed from the everlasting stream of his humanity. Eugene Halliday called himself simply artist. He was so in the full Renaissance sense of a man as microcosm of the macrocosmos, man as mediator of all things. Only very occasionally is the world of time honoured by the appearance of a great soul. That Eugene Halliday was such a one, let this example of his work be evidence. We all do well who read, mark, and inwardly digest it. The Nature of the Zeitgeist. The term Zeitgeist, literally translated time ghost, was formulated by German philosophers in the 19th century when the idea of history as a developing organic process first made itself deeply felt in the consciousness of man. Until this time, and this is still largely the unconscious habit today, men had thought of other men at other times as very much the same as themselves. And there are grounds for this attitude. Of course, learned men had always read books derived in part from the past, but until the invention of printing, such books were few and were mainly copies of theological and other works dealing with questions formulated within their own culture. These questions dealt mainly with ethical and moral matters. Clerks, who could read, pondered in their books questions which they considered, often rightly, were timeless in origin. But until the days of travel between one culture and another, between two cultures operating in the same epoch, travel between Europe and Asia, between Europe and America, the actions and concepts of men in another place were not an immediate concern. Comparisons between one place and another can only occur easily when there is travel between them physically. This became possible for Western Europeans about 500 years ago. And as men in the West began to read the travellers' reports of other places and of men and women who lived there, they began to reflect and compare the patterns presented to them. At the same time as this mobility in space occurred, there also occurred what we call the Renaissance, a term coined much later to explain the revival of interest in and knowledge of classical times. This interest was symbolically begun by the capture of Constantinople by the Turks and the removal of Greek scholars with their classical texts to the West. Thus men became generally aware at this point that there were other cultures in existence and that their own culture had an historic origin which they assumed, and rightly in Mediterranean lands, to have been that of Greece and Rome. However, although for 500 years since then, educated and intelligent men have known that there have been real differences between one place and another, and between one time and another, this did not become what we might call a living fact until about 150 years ago. By living fact is meant that man did not feel the difference between one epoch and another to be really significant. It was the similarities, not the differences, which were felt. An 18th century gentleman, for example, thought of a Roman patrician as a fellow being much in his situation, owning land, ruling peasants, judiciously extending the empire. Any support which he might find for his political action in statements derived from the past, he was willing to use. Thus the past was, as in popular Hollywood historical romances of our own day, a projection of those watching it and considering it. In the 18th century, this image was an aristocratic one, because aristocrats were considering the past. However, late in the 18th century, the feeling that there was a strange and barbarian time in our own culture started to appear, and the term Gothic was coined to refer to this past. By the 19th century, there was a very clear sense of history as a process of growth. Cultures were seen to develop by stages. every epoch was seen and felt to be a specific quality of experience. The German philosophers of the early 19th century became aware that the assumptions and attitudes of one period differed significantly from those of another. The basis changes from epoch to epoch. The cause of this apparent and felt difference they called the Zeitgeist, the spirit of the times. Before further considering different epochs in our own culture, let us first consider how the spirit, the Geist, comes to encapsulate itself in time. Eternal sentient power impresses itself temporarily in time as spirit making its first one turn, its intern, the universe. It internalizes itself in itself. That universe is eternally present, eternally created, eternally simultaneous. All beings created eternally and internally to that universe, however, as subsidiary universes, as being within God, that sphere greater than which we can conceive no other, experience that universe, a God, serially. The spirit in them looks out at the world, the spirit of their space-time. Insofar as men must conceive of space in which they live and move and have their being, they are like subsidiary entities experiencing the spirit as space-time power. Man is spirit, recognizing the totality of the universal environment, created eternally, creating now, to which he is subsidiary. A series of spirit-created worlds can be envisaged. The mineral world, power condensed, is spirit involved in one time. The vegetable world, which breaks and feeds off that mineral world, is power extended, and is spirit involved in another time. The animal world, power self-moving, is spirit in another time-space, eating, transforming, and modifying the experience presented to it. Finally, man, power conscious and evaluating, is a function of the spirit in time, and each epoch in man's history expresses a specific aspect of his nature and function. There is a continuous interplay between the spirit in man and the spirit in the universe around him. And as each individual man is in some respect unique in his space-time, so is each individual environment around him. The myth of Cain illustrates this point. We live out this myth daily as created and creative spirits. Cain is revealed as modifying and modified by the physical universe. That physical universe which is daily created for his time experiencing is the work of the spirit, and that time universe which he creates and changes in his own place, body and consciousness, is his spirit's response. Man is reborn every day, and in every epoch to a different set of stimuli, and both men and stimuli are possibilities from the beginning and presuppose each other. All possibilities of space-time are simultaneous in God, but in man's evaluation they are serial. He passes from place to place in time and meets the spirit at every turn. Consider man as berry gatherer, man in the golden age, man as stone age artist. As a spontaneous artist, his activity was a felt response by his spirit to the universe. Then soon the animals drawn by him were being hunted by him. He is pressed further into his environment and modified it and himself in consequence. Somehow he was provoked to hunt and to herd, because that was more efficient long-term hunting. Each response projected by him into the environment carried its own feedback. Man was provoked, as the myth of Cain makes clear, to provoke a desired stimulus called the fruits of the earth. As he carried on so doing, the environment was successively provoked by him to remodify and restructure itself as well as him, thus presenting him with further sets of stimuli. Each new set of stimuli seemed to him quite inevitable, insofar as he received them anew, as part of his life probing, adapted to them, and used them for his own benefit in reprovoking the environment in his capacity and nature as man. For man carries within himself, and this is important for the study of history, memories of previous responses. With these in mind, he provokes his environment, now unique, yet the partial result of man's previous actions. The generation of the time spirit, the Zeitgeist, is therefore self-opposing and paradoxical. Both man and time are active. Both man and time are passive. Each man and each time are unique. Each man and each time have been influenced by previous intention and previous creation. Space is a living body, a unifield, and time is the manner of its response as far as man is concerned. Let us now turn to man in society. The myth of Jacob and Esau describes the victory, again at a point in time, of the agriculturalist over the nomad, the red man. In a society of fixed agriculture, man provoked and received a highly intense zeitgeist experience. Because in such a highly organized closed situation as a fixed society, he was much sharpened by friction. His neighbors disturbed him constantly instead of sporadically. He was forced to mediate his anger via the law. He forced himself to do this at a moment in history. His hatreds became subtle, his discrimination acute, and the era called civilization was upon him. This was his action-response will in that space-time, and the situation in that space-time enabled him to respond. The pattern which man has forged in his space-pacing responses, in his time experience, can be called his culture. Each stage in the culture of any group is a series of energy tensions, coordinated responses, formulated into laws and codes of procedure. These laws and codes are the survival practice for that people in that time and place. So there is a culture in every epoch within the greater culture of a race, or tribe, or nation. We are now going to examine the history of our own culture, the culture called Western man. The term culture is preferred to the term civilization, because much which is valuable in our own or any culture is technically uncivilized, although highly artistic and inventive. The most important tool used by man in his articulate response and modification of his environment is his language. He projects himself, his image, his feelings, his acts, his ideas into the environment of his time, by and in language. His control over his language is his control over himself and over the zeitgeist. Many beings historically, lacking this control, have been at the mercy of the spirit of their times. Like Narcissus, they have identified with what they have heard and seen around them and inside themselves, unaware that they have provoked it, and as created beings, been provoked to provoke it. Let us begin our historic survey with the perfect human being, in an otherwise most imperfect epoch. Christ's appearance on earth was the watershed of our culture. Before he appeared, reflexive, self-conscious man was in gestation. Such a being was presaged in the acts and deeds of the prophets, but not in the conscious mind and memory of man. After his appearance, man, enlightened by this cosmic flashpoint, could envisage, by reference to Christ's life, actions, crucifixion and resurrection, the possibility of individual redemption, of constantly re-evaluating oneself. Thus, man was liberated from dependence upon definitions and institutions external to himself. Christ was, therefore, in a sense, the great counterstroke to the zeitgeist, with which man usually identifies himself. By highlighting the individual consciousness of man, he let in the growing seed of light into all subsequent cultures, which have, since his appearance on earth, developed an organic, changing pattern due to his infiltration of light into the consciousness of men, and an individual man at all historic stages since his birth. Some of these stages we are now to consider. Each of these is a zeitgeist, and each time-space and all its operative forms is modified by the consciousness of men moved by the memory of Christ's example. In the period since the death of Christ, each epoch, and as change grew more rapid, each century was such an epoch, may be seen to have developed a governing concept, a dominant feeling, and a most effective course of action. This amalgam of formed ideas and images within any culture constitutes the total response possibilities of men in that time and space. These responses were in turn their food for thought, feeling, and action. Out of the eater came forth meat. This meat was the memory nutriment of the next era, the next century, the next generation. Each governing concept is a force played into time. In the first 700 years of Christ's appearance on earth, when Europe was in relative turmoil and as the Roman Empire began its decline, man's highest energies were used to develop some integrating concept which would be his anchor in the flux of energies which this breakup of a rigid system of external static control involved. And as the fiery energies of the nomadic peoples pressed them further and further afield, as their grasslands were exhausted, men were worshipping the gods of appetite and tribal energy and cunning. Their desires were pushing them into external ravaging. Into this appetite flux of the period was projected the governing concept of the Trinity, the Incarnation and the Crucifixion. So were the wild horses of the time lassoed. The early fathers and those who developed the first Christian institutions stressed the significance of man bridling himself within the framework of Christ's ethical law. So, in this period, Western man is attempting to train himself to behave in a new way. He is to be self-bridled. He is to submit to the Christian law, self-imposed. The myth of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table relates to the imposition of this concept on tribal and energist man. The rule of law, derived in part from the Gospels, was to be substituted for raw appetite. This new law, also partly Greek, was not one which derived from external armed force. It was a law of internal spirit power recognition. The church was similarly a generative principle in these times. It provided a bastion and declared its work as guarding and extending the principles formulated by Christ, especially the crucifixion, expressed by his commandment, "Take up your cross and follow me." By the injection of this principle of the rule of law, as for example expressed in the works of St. Augustine, man was ruled and reined in. He learned to recognize, if not always to obey, the concept that a self-embraced, self-governing rule was the source of power and wisdom. Warring tribes needed a father to train them to sense, self-control, and virtue. This father was the early church. The early fathers were in this sense very real and stern fathers. They were dealing with very unruly sons. The times were stark and brutal, and the growth slow. Wisdom often consisted in rigidity. However, an ethical rule, based in some measure on Christ's life, was established. It was the time of Benedict's rule, and of Gregory's musical chant to soothe the wrathful and the faithful. Man was eventually institutionalized under a Christian emperor, under Charlemagne. His worldly kingdom, subsequently broken, was henceforth the model for all so-called Christian kings. The ring had been put upon the tribal beast. Man was to be fixed by his concept of his individual self. The notion of self-ringing had been embodied in the institutions under the banner of Christ. However, the strength of such limits was quickly tested in the next epoch. In the next 200 years to the first millennium, a new energy response in man reposited free initiative once more. The body of doctrine, which had been institutionally and rigidly imposed by Father Church, was challenged. The Northern Jarls, chieftains of Scandinavia, their name signifies those who are quick of spirit, these individual men demonstrated that pure initiative can break all bounds. They travelled to new continents and ringed the old by sea travel. The sea was a terrifying perimeter to early man. This terror they broke. They showed that in very small numbers, not in tribal migrations, man could break the tyranny of the known world and the sea beyond it. Man could break restrictions. Energist initiative could be embodied in one man and in small groups of men. Thus was demonstrated the power of individual men obsessed with freedom. So man could control himself by law. He could also break the law by himself. Belief was now shown to consist in pure initiative as well as in conformity to lawful action. All limits had to be tested at the physical and individual level. Virtue consisted not in physical performance, but in conquering the unknown and nameless hazards by individual initiative. The tribal appetite could be transcended in the individual appetite. Unconscious drive could be focused into pure initiative. This initiative then drove the Scandinavian Normans into territory fixing. The time for initiative demonstration had been fulfilled. In the period from 1000 AD to 1200 AD, pure initiative became involved in a place. That is, it set up its own law in the territories it had carved out. And here the relation of centre to perimeter was accurately defined. Here the rule of law, as applied to individual energist man, was embodied in the feudal system. Clearly defined opposites of church and state, of energist and conformist, braced the system. The Norman conquest in England and subsequent Viking-derived dynasties expressed the search in man for an ordered system which precisely structured duties and obligations. Individual earls were subjects of a king, and individual houses subject to a founder monastery, individual tenants subject to a lord. This arrangement allowed action within a territory and within the rigid rule or law of the church. Thus, within the doctrine, faith had to admit understanding. Anselm is confronted with Abelard, as the king is confronted by his earls. However, a structure is now established. Civilization is present in its buildings and written forms. The Book of Behaviour now has a sequel, the written defined Book of Property, the Domesday Book. The Romanesque architecture of the period reveals a column topped by an arch. Individual man could stand under the clearly defined law. God was established at the top of the feudal pyramid. This preparation of the ground, this ordering of function, this established tilling of the earth in Western Europe enabled a new level of soul to be glimpsed. Man felt suddenly free to aspire in his own right towards heaven. He could imagine a free dome within himself now. So rose the Gothic cathedrals, growing even higher and higher and dependent upon the pointed arch in stress, which stress had been established in feudalism. Man felt ripe for aspiration, for growth in sentience, ripe to let in light from its source, the East. Hence the Rose Window and the Crusades of the time. Hence the Romance of the Rose. It was the beginning of puberty in Europe. From 1200 to 1300 AD, woman as a personalized being appeared in the European consciousness. There was the first mention of the Virgin Mary and the first imaging of her. The virgin soul felt free. When Romance of the Rose was written, the troubadours were singing some unattainable woman's praise. St. Francis embodied the free soul, independent even of property. And the cathedrals rose higher and higher. Men flocked to them and to the church as to a mother. They experienced in their substance the whole multiplicity of light through the spectrum of the cathedral windows, not white light, for that was to come later. By 1300 AD, man was able to experience this very first feeling spring of his being. In the next century, having already experienced this troublous access of effective and aspiring love, he was tormented to see how it could be sent into action and enacted. He had to observe and extend himself so as to know who he might be. His embattled struggling energies provoked crises in the blood, crises at home within every state, plagues and rebellions. There was turmoil in the house between 1300 and 1400 AD. The church was beginning to break up. Somehow an individual consciousness was struggling to emerge and create relationship in its own right. The articulated consciousness of man as a person was taking shape. In the art of Giotto, a person, not an icon, appears. In the writings of Dante, there is the concept of the voyage of the individual soul. In the beginnings of perspective, there is a consciousness of the relation of here and there, of near to the being or far away. A separate individual is beginning to understand relation. So, therefore, after 1400 AD, as you are aware, everything is rightly measured from the appearance of Christ, the governing concept of the following century is that man can become, from his own centre, the measure of things. He is a sentient being who can move himself. He can become a beautiful spirit body in his own right. he glimpses individual acts as provocative of external affirmation, thus demonstrating, as in a sexual relation, the dependence upon other beings. He now expresses the idea of fame rather than the idea of chivalry as he has done before. The Renaissance has just begun. The pictures of Botticelli, the writings of Petrarch or Chaucer, the art of Van Eyck, reveal man as an individual about to achieve, by his own acts, by his own feeling assessment, a new independence of being. At the court of Florence and elsewhere, he flowers. He can think of himself as graceful and urbane. He can also free himself by his own native, natural language and thought, now for the first time set down in print from the tyranny of ancient and previous external rules. He is able to think out free alternatives in his own imagination. Church and state must be reconceived at the level of nation and city. What were the first gropings of the previous century have now become embodied in act. By 1500, there is the possibility of man acting to a felt yet defined purpose in his own right. The next century, from 1500 to 1600 AD, shows him as fulfilling this promise of activity. Now he conceives himself as a separate heroic initiative mover within his own tradition from the past. He recognizes Greece and Rome as his cultural ancestors, and he intends to re-become as them. He edits God's book, the Bible, in his own right. He asserts, discovers, performs, attempts to experience all things. He will become an heroic spirit to whom nothing is impossible. He moves out to all experience. European man tries to absorb the meaning of the Indies and of America. In his huge achievement, pictured in the monuments of Michelangelo, in the prose of Rabelais, in the aggression of Luther, in the extended vision of Copernicus, in this grand self-assertion he discovers not only a new heaven and a new earth, he also experiences self-opposition, self-laceration, and self-destruction in the Thirty Years' War. Man becomes a diabolic persecutor of man, conceptually and purposively. He becomes also an individual reflector on his own energist outburst. This reflection is mirrored in the works of Shakespeare and El Greco. This great outburst of energy and its consequences makes him withdraw into what can be clearly defined and enacted. In the 17th century, we see continuous care, precision of mind and endeavour. All the goblins of language and enthusiasm, of cant, of priestcraft, of poetry, of anything which might carry him into a feeling flood. The physical and describable universe is for the first time God's book. Experiment is now the clue to what is true. Being is equal to thought. Everything is to be concentrated on the precise search for the surety of truth, which consists in knowledge. Knowledge consists in the definitions of mathematics, where man can verify everything. Truth is the science of optics plus the definitions of mathematics, the mind interpreting sight. The clear white light of the mind is sought. Descartes and Spinoza, Vermeer and Galileo, Newton and Locke dominate a century which began with Shakespeare. The universe is proved to be a mathematical machine, and this is grounds for real surety. The scriptures can be understood by individual reason. Clear and distinct ideas are what characterize man. The scriptures are to a reasonable man, therefore, mostly stories in picture language, and poetry, because based on feeling and intuition, is now defined as a charming fable, a fancy. A man now finds virtue in reason and intelligence. He knows that as a sense-based being, using the mind, he can understand that the only sort of revelation possible is that in which the sense-based reason defines. Faith in miracles and the language of imagery is perhaps necessary for a vulgar people, but not for an intelligent man of judgment and sagacity. Above all, prose is the great vehicle of expression, and philosophy uses it to proper effect. Classify all sense data with the mind, says 17th century man. It is through the senses that you have come to be informed. Attempt nothing that has not been verified. In the succeeding century, from 1700 to 1800, the mind is turned from things and the physical universe to man. Man is a rational being and can be organized as such. Nature, the social embodiment of truth, is the purpose of man's endeavor. Nature means what man is defined as being, plus what he may be rationally expected to become in a properly structured world which obeys Newtonian mechanical laws. There is, therefore, every ground for moral optimism. Man is rational, perfectible, predictable, fixable. God is a country gentleman ordering his estates, not altogether averse from a little Baroque ornamentation, amused by pleasant ordered music, delighted by good form, distressed by occasional suffering, but seeing its inevitability for the perfection of the whole. And in the midst of this rational concentration on nature, one pragmatic mind takes the rational view of events to the term and discovers that there is really nothing about man or things that the mind as such can know. It simply records stimuli and assumes their identity for practical purposes. Perhaps an affective interest is really the ground of being and which synthesizes perceptions, but this is a small voice at the time. And then suddenly the best ordered and most natural of worlds explodes in violence and revolution. Men are hurried into conscious exploration of the heart. And so the 19th century reveals the tensions of this explosion of feeling, both in individuals and in groups. Reaction against the conceits of reason inverts into conservatism and the earnestness of religion into poetry and the imagination, into heroics and into passionate gesture, into harnessing energy and matter to prove mighty achievement. Now, feelings are not simply the prerequisite of courtiers and brilliant artists, but of many men. Yet it is an imperialism of the heart which manifests, and an imprisonment of the belly. Belief is somehow locked up in fierce passion, in energy particles. The passionate gestures conceal a coal mine furnace down below. Man becomes dual-functioned, looking down into matter for power, called science, and up into heaven for sentience, called art. The 20th century has seen such man-made gestures exhausted. It turns away to consider man as a relative object in space. It is concerned with the careful arrangements of physical patterns in space in the relation of form and motion. It knows that uncertainty about perceived objects is inevitable, so it attempts with mounting intensity to classify the motion and arrangement of all particles and all aspects of man and things in space. Like all previous centuries, it is faced with a paradox. The contemporary version is that the more it researches and classifies, the more dynamic and self-inverting the mappable complex becomes. But the aim is to chart all objects in space, and for this purpose, man is defined as a motion pattern and as chartable. So the modern virtue is not charity or even precision. It is not beauty or chivalry or fame or passion or reason. It is information. While all objects, including man, are known to be in a field relation, nevertheless there is great reluctance to relinquish the so-called advantages of defining him as a separate pattern space behavior system with all his motion tendencies listed. This is most useful for power demonstration purposes. In the 18th century, nature was what was rationally defined by certain men as the sum total of man's useful social functions and relations, though the motives of the definers were not made clear. In the 20th century, man is defined as a separate motion complex, adjustable in his movements and in his orbits by correctly structured information at all levels, physical, social, chemical, psychological, and so on. He has become a biological space laboratory for those defining themselves as space control. This very rapid summary of the zeitgeist in our own culture may lead us further to consider every form, material or ideational, which he makes and every feeling which he formulates as an expressed projection of his own sentient power into the field of his environment. As we have said, he is both formulated and formulating, responding and stimulating. What is important to stress is that every formulation which he makes is a significant aspect of his search to become a being of infinite power and to regain his origin. However he acts, he imagines himself at a certain level of development. Many men have seen his organic development as expressed in his invention. The word invention, blown in, suggests an extra-personal origin for the thing he designs. But the psychological preoccupations of every age, and the way power was envisaged and used in each epoch, may be revealed in every artifact. In the 8th century, the stirrup was invented. In the 14th, the rudder. In the 15th, the printing press. Between the 15th and 16th, telescopes and chronometers were developed. At such times, the world was thought of as a place best suited for the operation of such a device. The world was conceived as fulfilling the use for which the tool was invented. So to the stirrup inventor, the world is a horse conquest field. The world of the printing press inventor was a substance to be processed as serial thought. To the clockmaker, the world was a mechanical precision instrument. Men thought and felt in these terms. A different worldview accompanies whatever tools are invented. These inventions are an expression of the zeitgeist and reveal the psyche of that age. The steam engine, the internal combustion engine, the aeroplane, and the satellite all reveal and permit different physical and psychological ways of life. The multiplicity of inventions in the last 70 years has had by now the feedback effect of patterning our expectancy so intently that we now assume mechanical invention to be a necessary way of life. We now impose upon ourselves and upon others, as by right, ever more stimulating and complex mechanical designs. We are coming to see the world and everyone in it as an inventive exercise for an individual man. If we consider the world of art, we see that here, as in the case of artifacts, every time has imaged itself forth in the imagination of men. Their inner dispositions are revealed, their struggles to overcome their own passivity and to achieve freedom. If we consider very briefly some views of the hero at different times in the literature of our culture, we see that each epoch has been provoked to value different images of power and of effective action. Odysseus, an epic hero, was above all resourceful and cunning. Galahad, a chivalric hero, was compassionate and pure. Hamlet, a Renaissance hero, was finely gifted in all parts, internal and external. Pierre Besukhov, a romantic hero, is passionate, confused, and soul-searching. The 20th century hero, Proust or Bloom, is simply sensitively suffering from all forms of internal memory and external fear, and is simply able to survive. Such images of men represent their epoch in the most accurate way. These images also provide fertile ground for identification by the most responsive men of the time. They represent patterns of action which men feel compelled to follow in quite unconscious ways. In every epoch, the three parts of man are compounded to form a total image. There is an artistic aspect to the zeitgeist expressing itself in literature, the visual arts, and in music. In literature, each epoch expresses itself in poetry or in prose. Epics were songs in verse and celebrated deeds of valor and power. None has been heard for 1,000 years. When societies choose drama as their primary form of expression, they are attempting to body forth the creative process in act, so in Greece and so in Shakespeare's England. Lyric poetry appears at a time when the heart of individuated man feels it can make some act of significant communication in its own right. The novel is written when a multiplicity of accidental events, external or internal, begins to fascinate men's consciousness. In poetry, men value power intuitings, in prose, rational analysis. Portraiture, in statuary or on canvas, has accompanied these epochs in the past when individuals wield considerable power. Perspective in art represents the need to locate objects and men in space relation. landscape, the need to understand the forces moulding the earth. And abstract art reveals the will to design from internally defined dimensions and relations. In music, voices, instruments, scales, and modes make their appearance from century to century and express all the psyche of man more immediately than any other art. The common factor in all art forms is that they represent the zeitgeist style. Style is the expression of beauty, the soul's impress upon the substance. Each age mirrors its aspiration in its style. Beauty represents man's power to flow into and to re-become all things. So, it might be said that the whole psyche of Western man was compressed into the well-tempered clavier, or into the sonnet, or into the portrait of a king, each at different times in our culture. Thus, it is possible for a sensitive man to pinpoint an epoch on being presented with a sequence of a few words in prose or verse, which he has not previously heard, or with an artifact, or with a few notes of music previously unknown. This is because these things have not been made at any other time, in just such a fashion. In every other epoch, likewise, there is a formulation by thinkers about the nature of man's power and origin. Values to which men commit their total energies are redefined from century to century. Every zeitgeist is a survival situation from the point of view of those internal to it. Men feel the need to remake their kind of life definition so as to survive. God and the devil are continuously redefined and re-imaged. Truth and falsehood are redefined in every age. Sin and merit re-promulgated. Freedom and bondage tricked out in new forms. Being and becoming are made to conform with what is realizable by any group at any time. All these definitions are fed into the educational structure so that the young go forth carrying them as unconscious determinants in their lives. With these ideas, they attempt to deal with the new zeitgeist, with which the movement of the sidereal and solar systems presents them. So man's heart beats out its message in every age, and his head redefines its truth. Behind these lies the power of each culture to produce food and wealth. Each epoch therefore witnesses a specific system of cultivation and economic development. A certain quantum of energy is needed to break the land. Certain men take possession of given territories and dictate the manner of the land use. Availability of capital and the nature of its investment in plant demonstrate the growth of a culture within the historical soil. Material wealth and power, patterned in political state institutions, tribe, nation, state, etc., reveal, as was the case in inventions and in the arts, a culture's response to the total forces of the times as they are then felt to operate. And every physical building made is a symbol of man's response in his own time and place. For instance, when the great cathedrals were being built, medieval man's aspirations were towards a heaven above him. Hence, he sacrificed everything to the creation of the Gothic spires. When he depended upon the construction of a precise dogma, domes appeared. Similarly, the dress of man, the glass of fashion, is most obviously a signature of an age. All types of garment, for work, for ceremony, for ritual, for leisure. These are so many landmarks of the historical process. Man is continuously projecting his image. He is eating cosmic radiation in time. The image that he formulates is the meat prior to the next eating. We may therefore reformulate what has been stated. Each epoch is a field of power. Each formulation within that field is a counterstroke which modifies it. Artists and philosophers formulate and therefore modify, and must respond to the modification. At any moment in time, each formulator feels himself to be on the frontier of survival. now feels to each one of us as far as it is possible to get. We feel a compulsion to exist, to formulate, to improve. In every space-time, a vacuum, the future seems to need filling. A sense of deficiency seems inherent in the condition of man in time. The degree of man's insistence upon rigid systems of truth, beauty, and goodness may reflect the degree of his felt insecurity in the zeitgeist. Yet there seems to be some who have transcended to some degree this instinctive projection survival response. We have only to consider artists such as Shakespeare or Michelangelo or Beethoven in our own culture to be convinced of this. Yet each age, and the men in it, seems to carry psychic memories, inbuilt response patterns from the past, and premonitions and tremulations regarding the future. Men of understanding are therefore concerned to probe and find out why they respond to stimuli, internally and externally, in the way they do and feel right to do so. For it would appear that this right is an unconscious response to the zeitgeist. It is rooted in identification with the tradition and culture to which the responder belongs. If we consider our own responses in our own time to the environment around us, we may distinguish three levels of movement. First, we respond according to ancestral identification. We may note in ourselves particular interest in specific ideas or objects, all of which have historic origin. We also live in the epoch of our own biological time. First, in the associations with the affective conditioning of our childhood, and also by identification with our period of sexual growth power, usually in late adolescence or early manhood. This produces operative memories in quite different conditions, insofar as the being we were then seems to be us. Lastly, we live in an actual contemporary situation, our time situation, which apparently moulds us. Some men have suggested that we are almost the puppets of the culture of our birth and growth. This led 18th century perfectionist philosophers to think that all evil lay with governments. This thought itself, however, was equally a product of its time. In conclusion, we may see that time and men in time are not two. Both in their interactions constitute the zeitgeist. We spirits have selected our language and our culture, our place in geographic space and in historic time. We opt for our time experience. A marriage has taken place between every man and his temporal environment. Accordingly, if man identifies unconsciously with his time situation and looks out into it for his food, resource and stimulation, for his longed-for condition of liberty and justice, for his pleasure, affirmation and reward, then he simply perpetuates the act of Cain. He increases his knowledge of external power, yet he becomes bound to respond to the external time appearance, excited by his time and the memories which it produces in him. If, however, he reflects upon these otherwise automatic internal movements, he may, eventually, be able to act at right angles to the serial time process and into the eternal. He may discover the power source which appears to be manifesting as a stimulus to his senses, mediated through the acts and ideas and emotions which his time provides. If we reflect in this way, we shall see the ghost behind the time. We shall be able to distinguish the God in the machine. We shall be free to observe what is being created in and by ourselves and avoid the error of identification for which Cain had the mark placed so firmly on his brow. Thank you for listening to the Eugene Halliday podcast. Please subscribe to receive notifications of future episodes.